Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Environmental Studies. My name is Patricia Hauser, and my guest today is someone with unique insights into a critical event in environmental history. As we approach the 10th anniversary coming up in April 2024 of the Flint water crisis, I so appreciate having as my guest the author of the book, Flint Fights Back, Environmental Justice and Democracy in the Flint Water Crisis. Dr. Benjamin J. Pauley is Assistant Professor of Social Science at Kettering University. Dr. Pauley, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
As I say, it's really timely. And I think for anyone studying environmental issues, you just can't get enough out of the Flint case study. To get started, I'm wondering, can you, for those who may be a little rusty on their history of this or for some reason may have not been aware of the news at the time, can you just give a sort of a recap or reminder? What happened in Flint? What was the Flint water crisis?
Well, in many ways, that's a subject of ongoing debate and discussion because the crisis means different things to different people, and people do draw different kinds of boundaries around it, including boundaries around, you know, when it began and when it was over, if indeed it is over. And that's something we can certainly discuss. The usual way of telling the story of the water crisis is to go back to April 2014. That's when the city of Flint, which at that time was under the control of a state-appointed emergency manager, and we can talk more about what an emergency manager is as we go along, but suffice to say, it was not local elected officials who were in charge at that time. The decision was made by the emergency manager to proceed with a switch of Flint's drinking water supply from Lake Huron water that was treated and supplied by the city of Detroit through a Detroit-owned and operated regional water system, to the Flint River. Anytime you make a water source change, it just introduces new variables into your water system, and it has a disruptive effect. It was disruptive to what was already an aging, somewhat dilapidated water infrastructure. Flint, like many other cities, has water pipes that are in some cases going on 100 years old that are sorely in need of repair, if not replacement. And that disruption started to manifest itself pretty quickly in a number of different ways. So people started to notice changes to the taste of their water, to the color of their water, to the smell of their water, to the texture of their water. And those were sort of the first alarm bells that went off for residents. Now, many were wary of drinking Flint River water in the first place because the river did have a very bad reputation as a polluted industrial river. But theoretically, if the water had been properly treated, it wouldn't have led to all of these various issues that I'm describing. And so that's really where the crisis began for a lot of residents, is with noticing changes to their water quality. Eventually, it was found that there was some bacterial contamination in parts of the water system that led to some boil water advisories in the late summer of 2014. General Motors found that the water was corroding some of its engine parts at one of its local plants and got special permission to switch off from the river water back onto Lake Huron water. And so by that time, you know, there was some alarm that a lot of residents were feeling about the overall water quality and what the water might be doing to their bodies. But, you know, eventually people started to realize that if the water was corroding engine parts, then it was probably corroding the pipes. I mean, they were seeing that with the brown water that people would bring in bottles to community meetings and so forth. That's iron. That comes from iron water mains. The bigger threat, and this took longer to realize, but the bigger threat from a public health perspective was that that corrosive water was traveling through lead pipes and it was picking up little pieces of lead along the way. And so people eventually realized that they were being exposed to lead. That really turned out to be the contaminant that kind of broke the story open.
Right. And you hear about that, right?
But it's not the only thing that people were worried about by any stretch of the imagination. There were worries also about what are called disinfection byproducts. So when we dump chlorine into water, it creates some chemical reactions that can generate carcinogens. The level of disinfection byproducts in the Flint system was high for a while. We haven't touched yet upon Legionnaires' disease. It's, you know, again, a lot of people, when they think of Flint, they think of lead, but you could make the case that the most significant public health outcome of the whole crisis was that we had people dying in Flint of waterborne disease caused by a particular bacterium, Legionella pneumophila. And this is the deadliest waterborne disease in the United States. And we had at least 12 or so people die, and maybe many more, of Legionella. So it wasn't just lead. It was this kind of accumulation of concern around bacteria, the byproducts, eventually lead, that led to a swelling of popular demands to get off of the Flint River.
Right. And this is a city at the time. So we're talking about 2014, the time of the switch. They're switching from a famously pristine source, or relatively, you know, really good water, to... they decide, let's go with the industrial river that's a famously noxious source that people have just commented on that's particularly awful. There's trouble with the water right away. And then what's interesting about the perspective that you bring to it is you move to town in the middle of this. You come to town with a fresh PhD and you start teaching in a university, but you're also confronted with, as a person with a young family, the issue of water, because your PhD is not in water quality.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a whole lot of learning to do. My degree's in political science, but it's not even in, like, you know, environmental politics or anything like that. Something like lead and water. In fact, I didn't even know that there was such a thing as a lead water pipe. You know, when we moved here, we had heard from a neighbor that there had been some, you know, issues with the water, but our sense was that the water utility had those under control, that there was not any pressing threat to ourselves, much less to public health. And so, you know, we were all exposed at that time. And it wasn't until a colleague pulled me aside in the hallway at my university and said, "Have you heard they're finding lead in the water?" that we started to realize that there was a bigger issue. And at that point, it became firstly just a matter of trying to figure out how to keep our son safe and how to keep ourselves safe. And so, you know, we entered into what at that time was a pretty kind of mystifying world of water treatment solutions at the household level, various kinds of filters and so forth.
But then here you are, you have this specialty within academia. Your theoretical base is really strong, and you're an ethnographer. And all of a sudden you say, oh, I can study water too. So what are you thinking you can accomplish as an academic that will help?
Yeah, it's a good question, because my main thought at first was, how could I get involved just as a concerned resident? At the beginning, anyway, I kind of saw that as being, in some sense, in direct conflict with my academic work, which was on a totally different topic. I had to make the decision to totally table the other academic work I was doing and to find some way of putting an academic spin on my involvement. Knowing that I wasn't an expert in any way on water, I was looking for some kind of angle that I felt I could write about coherently. And it just so happened that the activists that were already mobilized around the water issue within the community were not just talking about water. They were talking about democracy.
Right.
And they were doing so very prominently as kind of part of their discourse around the crisis. And that perked up my ears, because, you know, I liked to think of myself as having a little bit of knowledge about democracy, having a background in political theory and so forth, and having written about issues relating to democracy over the years. And so I started paying more attention to that aspect of the activist discourse. And I started to realize that there was a bigger story there, that, yes, it was true that specifically in Flint, there were unelected people who were making critical decisions about water. But that wasn't just going on in Flint. That was going on in other communities in the state of Michigan. And there were issues being raised here that were really relevant to some pretty big and broad questions of democracy nationwide and beyond. And so, you know, the other thing that I learned pretty quickly in all of this is that I actually was not the expert in democracy by any means. It was those folks who were not academics, but who just had been fighting this fight and paying attention to what was going on. They knew way more about even that angle than I understood at first. And so even on the democracy front, I found myself just doing a lot of listening and learning from people on the ground. And the analytical framework that I ultimately incorporated into the book was one that was just very much inspired by that kind of listening. It wasn't me coming in with some fancy theory that I wanted to try to use Flint to prove or something like that. I tried to be really careful about that stuff.
So in each chapter of your book, it gives examples of what was happening on the ground. You give specifics and then connect that to a larger picture of causes and effect. The example I want to give is, you open chapter 5 with a description of two local moms who personally experienced the effects of bad water, while authorities were telling them the whole time, this is for months on end, that the water was okay. So you give that example, and then you go on to explain related concepts, including an idea called epistemic injustice. I am leading up to a question here. Actually, there are two parts. Part one, I wonder if you would describe a bit of the harms of bad water personally experienced by households, like the households of these two women, Melissa Mays and Leanne Walters. And part two would be, can you explain what epistemic justice is, at least get to that, and how it's related to the experience of those moms?
So in the chapter you're referring to, chapter 5, what I'm really trying to do is kind of bring things down to the level of lived experience. And one of the reasons why I do that is precisely because I don't feel like I am always in a great position to kind of judge from above what is happening and what isn't and who's been harmed and who hasn't and so forth. I don't know if anybody has the expertise to do that definitively.
Okay.
But, you know, at the very least, what I can say is that this situation was experienced as a crisis in a variety of respects by the residents who were living here. You know, that's before you get into any kind of scientific debate over, well, did this thing really cause this thing or whatever? I mean, we can get into some of that controversy, but certainly on the ground, on the level of living everyday life, this situation was profoundly disruptive in the cases that you mentioned. So we're talking about people who were either noticing issues with the water straight away, or were noticing issues with their bodies or with the bodies of their children that were out of the ordinary, that they ended up hypothesizing were related to the water. So that was everything from rashes to hair falling out. One of the residents you mentioned had her eyebrows essentially fall out completely.
Right.
You know, various kinds of other skin ailments. Also issues with respiration, cognitive issues. So they were noticing that their children were having trouble focusing and that their performance in school was slipping. So again, these are the kinds of health symptoms that in theory could have been attributed to any number of things. But because there was this really significant change in their lives with respect to their water, they had a strong inkling that it might have something to do with that. It was that hypothesis that really, and I think that's the way we should describe it, by the way, is what we start seeing with these moms and with other residents is a kind of proto-scientific activity taking place here, where you've got people hypothesizing a causal relationship between an environmental substance, in this case water, and some kind of a health outcome. And they have good reason to hypothesize that, because they know their own lives better than anybody else.
Right.
They can see when things have changed. And so it's those kinds of observations that spur them to start investigating. And they do that in a variety of ways. They start testing their own water. They start looking things up online. When the city would put out press releases about disinfection byproducts or something like that, some of these residents would launch an investigation of their own into what these things were and how they worked and what their harmful effects could be. And so they were doing all of this research. And what's more, they were doing it not only on an individual level, they were starting to come together and do it collaboratively. And of course, that's also one of the things we expect out of science, is that when there's an important inquiry to be made, it's not just one person making the inquiry. They are in some way putting themselves into conversation with others who are contributing to that enterprise.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
What you end up with then is a collective understanding of the phenomenon that goes beyond what you would get at the individual level. And so people started finding each other on social media. They started finding each other in meetings, you know, related to water. And they started forming groups and, you know, working together to understand what was going on, but then also increasingly on the advocacy side. And once they started turning towards advocacy, then the question became, how are we going to take what we think we understand about what's going on with the water and turn that into somebody else's understanding, and to do it in a way that will inspire some kind of action on their part?
Right.
And that's when you start running into some of the barriers that I describe in that chapter, with people not being believed, with people being treated like they're dumb or they're lying, or that they just, through no fault of their own maybe, but just don't have the kind of professional expertise that they would need to put things in comparative perspective or to detect patterns in the proper way. So I use this idea of epistemic injustice to capture those kinds of responses, where you had people who weren't being believed, not so much because they didn't have meaningful evidence, but because the claims that were being made about what was going on were coming from a certain kind of person, somebody who didn't have a degree,
right,
or who was just a mom, or, you know, was a person of color, maybe, who wasn't used to getting taken seriously by the folks at the front of the room.
Even though, and you have this great picture of one of those women holding a water that's really brown, saying, "This came out of my tap." And she's saying, "This is what you're saying is okay to give to my kid." And he just blew it off.
But he didn't believe that it had really come out of her tap. And so what you started to see on social media was that people would not only take pictures of brown water, they would take video of brown water coming straight out of the tap, whether that was at the kitchen faucet or in the bathtub. So you had residents that were also starting to think about the quality of the evidence that they were presenting and what made for better evidence in these scenarios. And again, they weren't doing that so much to like convince themselves that there was a problem. You know, it was obvious that there was a problem. And the problem was that the way in which they were presenting the evidence was making them vulnerable to skepticism or pushback on the part of experts and officials.
Okay.
And so then, and really, you kind of saw two different strains of thinking emerge within the burgeoning water movement. One was, okay, they're not going to listen to anything we say because you can shove the dirtiest water you like in their faces and they're going to tell you that it's fine somehow. At the end of the day, they're just lying and they don't care what they do to us. And so we just need to find some way of forcing them to do what we need them to do. The other strain of thinking was that what we need here is a different kind of evidence, the kind of evidence that's more likely to be taken seriously, that's more likely to inspire action, and that is more, quote unquote, scientific and less arguable. And that was the language that these activists would use in describing this thinking to me, is that science is inarguable. Once you've got your scientific data, then you're dealing with hard facts that people can't just dismiss. And so their thinking was that if we could do some kind of a scientific study of the water and present that as evidence, then that was going to be more likely to result in the change that they wanted to see. It so happened that some of these activists got connected to some scientific helpers, you know, who were coming in from the outside and lending their credibility to the sampling that these activists led on the ground. And that ended up being an important piece of this story. It turned out that indeed it did matter to have people with certain kinds of recognized authority kind of lending their stamp of credibility to claims that were coming out of the community, and helping the community also to gather more evidence that there was a problem.
It just highlights another theme from your book, which is sort of the persistence of the activists and the learning curve that they imposed upon themselves in the face of these different levels of indifference, of who knows what, incompetence, and allegedly criminal acts. So many dangerous things going on, and these activists weren't getting listened to. but you're sort of explaining, no, this isn't just a few really callous people not listening to people. This is a phenomenon in society. You use this term epistemic injustice. And of course, epistemology is how we know things, right? You're saying that certain kinds of information in society are dismissed because the people listening are dismissing what we know and how we know it?
Yeah, what the idea of epistemic injustice, and I'm sorry, I should have given a fuller account of that term earlier, but the idea is that we assign different kinds of status to different kinds of knowers within our culture, right? So if you've got the letters after your name and the scientific degree and so forth, chances are that you're probably going to end up, I mean, these days, yes, there's a lot of pushback against science and scientists. We don't want to deny that. But on an everyday level, a lot of the time, it's the opposite, is that if you have those credentials, people are quite ready to believe that you know what you're talking about, and you right. might actually end up with more credibility than you really deserve, right? On the other end of the spectrum, in Flint, we've got a very troubled educational system. We've got people who, in many cases, aren't ending up with even a high school degree, much less a college degree, much less any kind of fancy professional credential. And because we place a lot of significance on that sort of thing within our society, we might be inclined to look at somebody without that kind of education as not really being a knower when it comes to this kind of stuff. What could you really know about water quality just through using the water in your house? Wouldn't you have to study that on some bigger, broader level? The idea that people who lack certain kinds of credentials have less epistemological credibility is an important part of this. But then beyond that, I think there's a gender component here. There's a race component. These women that were speaking out were dismissed as being hysterical, the way women often are when they're making claims about what's going on, even with their own bodies. People of color are used to this as well, where, again, they can make the most beautiful logical argument that something is wrong. But there's going to be a knee-jerk skepticism sometimes, you know, because of who they are. And so that is a form of epistemic injustice, the way that I'm using the term.
So you mentioned there are these various components, including racial. Could Flint have happened? Could the crisis have happened there if it hadn't been a majority Black community?
It's a good question, because this is a community that was marginalized to begin with in many, many ways. And it became increasingly marginalized over the years as it shifted from being a majority white city to being a majority African-American city. And I don't think that that's an accident. When the industry started to leave Flint and when the Black population started to actually exert some political influence and get some recognition of its civil rights, that's when many of the white folks in Flint fled for the hills. And they took, of course, their money with them. They took a big part of Flint's tax base with them. Okay. And so you ended up with a city that, yes, African Americans increasingly had more and more control over in terms of the institutions of local government and so forth. But at that very same time, the economy of the city was collapsing and it became less and less able to do things for itself. I mean, even basic city services became very, very hard to sustain. Things like water infrastructure repair and replacement became very hard to fund with any kind of local money. And politically, Flint ended up as just one of these kind of cordon off areas within these Midwestern states where, again, you've got, yes, African Americans who are largely in control of what's going on politically in that realm. But then outside of Flint, you've got a majority white state that leans conservative. Mm. We had a super majority Republican control of our state house back when some of these early decisions were being made about Flint. And so it's politically marginalized, it's economically marginalized, and all of that was happening as it was becoming an African-American city. And so in those very kind of fundamental structural ways, the fact that Flint is majority Black and the fact that it had a water crisis, these things do go together. And there's just no denying, you know, that there is a role of that kind of historic structural racism in putting Flint into a precarious position with respect to its water and with respect to so many other things that people depend on.
Okay, so there's much more discussion of classism and the issue of relative poverty in this city, but also environmental justice generally and distributive justice that are worth exploring in this book. I just want to take advantage of your immersion in the activist community there. In light of what you saw, what insights can you share in terms of particular activist groups that were successful or particular tactics of activism that succeeded in Flint? I mean, kudos to all the people that just hung in there and got the attention for their cause that they needed and got things turned around to some extent. But were there techniques or were there groups? So go ahead, whatever.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Of course, it's kind of like one of these million-dollar social science questions is what exactly is it that created the change, right, that you want to understand? And don't let anybody tell you that they know for sure, you know, what it is, because there are just so many variables here to take into consideration. And I wouldn't pretend to, you know, have added them all up in a mathematically rigorous way or anything like that. But I will say one of the things that you're touching upon is persistence. I mean, I think that persistence has a lot to do with that. And sometimes even persistence of a small group of people can be the wedge that opens up larger possibilities. And so I think we saw some of that kind of persistence on the part of this quarter group of activists that I put at the center of the story in the book. Beyond that, I think one of the things that brought people together in those early days is that there was one pretty straightforward demand that everybody was making, and that was get us off of the Flint River. And, you know, people did have some differences of opinion as far as how exactly to pursue that demand. But just having people united on the level of having a shared objective is super helpful. One of the things that we saw after we switched back off of the river here was that you had different groups starting to make different sets of demands, and you ended up with people kind of being on different pages at that point. And you ended up with some factionalism arising within the activist community.
Yeah, that's an interesting discussion in the book.
To me, that's part of how you explain that, is that it became more ambiguous at that point as far as what the priorities should be, not to mention how to pursue them. And so you had some divides that at least weren't as significant earlier on in that later phase of the movement. So that's a big one, is getting onto the same page as far as demands. There was also a diversity of tactics that were used. And I think to me, that is one of the lessons that we can derive from social movement history, is that, you know, you don't just have Martin or Malcolm, you have Martin and Malcolm, you know, you have people who are contributing in different ways to bringing attention to a particular set of issues and who are maybe espousing different tactics as ways of addressing that issue. And so we had groups, again, in Flint that were really big on the whole let's collect more data thing. And then you had others that were more focused on getting people out into the streets and causing a ruckus. And sometimes that can be really useful and necessary from a tactical perspective. You had people that were petitioning kind of within the system, trying to get the mayor or other officials to take some kind of action. You had people filing suits in the courts, in the court system, you know, to try to move things along on that front. And so I think having that multi-front approach is usually pretty key if you want to make a big change.
So unity of message, diversity of tactics, people working within the system. And
persistence, working within and outside at the same time, I think is really important, because we had a little bit of both of those strategies going on here. I think that sometimes we underestimate the extent to which those two tacks can actually be reconcilable insofar as they're coordinated in some way. You know, when you've got people working within, working without, even if at the end of the day, you're left with whatever the system is willing to give you, as opposed to, you know, creating some alternative system. If you've got people working outside of it, sometimes you can pull it further along. To me, the stuff that I call outside the system, it's more of what in the social sciences we call the contentious politics stuff. It's this, you know, where you're getting people who are applying pressure, not through the voting box or not by going down and talking to the mayor or whatever, but they're out in the streets trying to drum up concern and mobilizing people in different ways. Again, maybe ultimately you are pressuring people who are located within the system to do one thing or another, but you're not doing it in kind of the usual accepted ways.
So you go through the list of things that tend to help activists be successful. You talk about citizen science a lot in different contexts. And I just wonder, could that be thrown into the list of what activists should be thinking about being part of their toolbox? Only as a way of breaking through what you call that epistemic issue of people not respecting what you know or how you know it.
No, I think that's right. I think that there are a lot of communities that benefit from being able to wield the tools and the language of science, you know, in the service of their cause. Number one is realizing that you're not necessarily tainting science by bringing it into close relationship with people who are struggling within their communities. Beyond that, I think sometimes we really underestimate the scientific chops that people within these communities either already have or can develop. And part of what we need to do is recognize more of what's going on with communities as a kind of proto-scientific activity that's on a continuum with more academic or professional science, that you don't have this sharp dividing line between science and non-science or anti-science or whatever, right? It's actually more of a spectrum. And the more that we can kind of validate what people are already doing, but also insofar as it's necessary, get them trained up in other kinds of tools and techniques, then the better position we put them in to make their claims and advance their interests.
I wanted to pause for a moment and ask for your take as the 10th anniversary of the water crisis approaches. How is Flint doing today? Does everyone in the city have clean water now? Has justice been served? I've been seeing the awards of money from various lawsuits to the people of Flint, but has justice been served, whatever that means?
Sure. Well, I mean, justice looks like a whole lot of different things to your average resident, I think, at this point. Part of it is, yes, ensuring that everybody has clean water, safe water. And within any large public water system, it is pretty much impossible at any given time to say in a general way that everybody has clean and safe water for some of the reasons that we discussed before. Certainly on average, water quality has improved a lot here. If you're looking at lead, if you're looking at chlorine or any number of other indicators. But one of the things that I think the water movement in Flint has been really concerned about is ensuring that people don't slip through the cracks. And sometimes when we go around, you know, talking about system-wide averages or making sweeping claims about the water being safe or even just comparatively safe, then we run the risk of people slipping through some of those cracks that we've learned about along the way. And so sometimes when you see activists in Flint pushing back against the message that the water is safe, it's not because they're denying that there's been overall improvement to water quality. It's because they're really worried about the folks who still haven't been taken care of. We've still got people with lead service lines in this city after all of these years. We've got dilapidated water mains, as I was saying before, that still need repair and replacement. We've got a lot of issues. And so because people have come to understand more about that whole range of issues, they're pretty reluctant to say that the crisis is over. Why don't we instead say that we've still got work to do and then focus on doing that work? And part of that work is the work of reparation. You mentioned the money. We have a big settlement that is still getting processed right now, but the state of Michigan chipped in $600 million, a variety of other entities that got sued. And on paper, it looks like a very impressive sum indeed. But in practice, we're going to have residents of the community that might not see more than $1,000 from that, even after everything that they've experienced. And so we are going to end up with people whose lives really are not going to be changed or repaired in any meaningful way by the little piece of that money that they end up getting. And so I think it's inevitable that there are going to be a lot of people who feel like justice hasn't been done, even with that much money coming people's way. In terms of legal accountability on the criminal side, we've had a variety of criminal charges filed by two different attorney generals over the years, and those have now all evaporated because our latest attorney general in her office made such grievous mistakes in the way they went about prosecuting these cases that they left themselves vulnerable to pushback in the courts. And so all of the charges were thrown out on a procedural basis.
I heard about that.
And that's the end of it as far as criminal accountability. So I think it's safe to say like that was very much a slap in the face that we didn't even have folks go to trial, much less get convicted of anything.
To conclude the conversation then, from your informed perspective on all this, what are some lessons from the Flint water crisis? What can we learn from what happened there?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think that it's okay for people to learn different things from Flint. So again, the story that I have highlighted in my book is the story of a not even the whole community, but a group of residents who became activists if they weren't activists to begin with, and that were just trying to keep themselves and their fellow residents safe. And there's a lot that we can learn from that part of the story about the importance of collective action and some of those specific lessons around what makes for effective collective action that we touched upon earlier. But there are all kinds of other people that have taken different lessons away from Flint. And again, I think that's okay. One of the things we've learned is that we really need to invest more as a society in our drinking water infrastructure. I think it's time to redouble our commitment to tap water in a way that not only involves more investment, but that also involves having a more nuanced conversation about what tap water consists of and the extent to which our regulatory system really guarantees safe water at the tap to everybody. We need to do a better job of educating folks about how to be that last line of defense and how to keep themselves safe within their own homes. We need to change the regulations that are in place to begin with, like the federal lead and copper rule, in order to tighten them up and close some of those loopholes. We also need to take a look at what's going on the political side. Is it okay for a state or any other governmental entity to come into a community and sweep elected representatives aside and to decide from the top down how a community's affairs are going to be run? So that's a whole bundle of issues in and of itself that is relevant not only in Flint, but to many other communities that are finding their autonomy and self-determination challenged in some way.
So as we lead up to a closing, I just want to make sure I tell listeners about the availability of this book. Ben Pauley, his book, Flint Fights Back, Environmental Justice and Democracy in the Flint Water Crisis, published in 2019 by MIT Press, is available online now. Been
And it's
so
free. It's open access. So it's freely downloadable online if
it's an
you
open access resource, and I just want to
have
say
the
the
e-version.
more, just when I think I understand the situation in Flint, I read parts of your book and there's just more to know, and this is a great resource to dip into and share. Many thanks to Dr. Benjamin J. Pauley for sharing his insights on the New Books Network.